Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. Today we're going to try and pick up a few more of questions from listeners. Quick reminder, we enjoy reading your emails, questions, feedback, disagreements, so please do keep those coming in. Molad, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk, or if you're on Twitter, or X, as I believe we should now call it, you can message me. I'm at T-S Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. But we've had a question coming in from a listener called David, who listened to our recent episode about baby loss, and in particular the second part discussing abortion here in the UK. And he says this: I was puzzled by your comment where you said of the narrative, it's my body and I'll do as I want, as described it as a myth. If I understand you correctly, you explain that the high abortion rates were having more to do with social pressure, for example, typically from unsupportive partners. However, in setting the scene for the podcast, we hear that the most typical scenario for increased abortion rates is not, as might previously be thought, teenage pregnancies and single mothers, but it's rather women in their 20s who are typically in long-term stable relationships and who want sex but don't want a baby yet, for example, until they turn into their 30s. If one in three women will have abortions, how can this be a myth?
Yeah, so, I need to row back a bit from what I said last time, because, well, let me unpack a bit what I meant by saying that it was a myth. I think it's easy to have a caricature that says, you know, so many women are basically just irresponsible, and they understand the risks of sex, but when they discover they're pregnant, they just wish to get rid of the baby because it's a free choice, because it's my body and I can do whatever I like. And I think, although that must happen sometimes, I don't think that that is the common kind of narrative. And it's certainly what I hear fed back from those counselors who on a regular basis talk to women with unplanned pregnancy and who are agonizing about whether or not to continue the pregnancy, is that the kind of narrative they feel is that they just don't have a choice. Now, although they understand in theory, I could continue with this pregnancy, in reality, it is simply unrealistic or inconceivable. And the sort of reasons include things like, I'm not ready to be a parent. I haven't got the appropriate kind of maturity. You know, I have very high ideals of how I should be as a parent, and now is not the right time for it. Financially, I'm just at the wrong time. I understand that having a child is incredibly expensive, and at the moment, I'm financially unstable. So if I did have a child, that means that the child would undergo real financial hardship because I'm not ready. And very often it is a relational thing. I mean, as was said, many women are in a long-term stable relationship, but either explicitly or implicitly, they get the message from their partner that they don't want to have this baby. They're not ready to be a father. And so the woman, again, is this agonizing decision, you know, do I go ahead and have the baby and jeopardize my relationship, maybe cause long-term bitterness or relationship breakdown? You know, do I vote for my partner or do I vote for a baby? So often I think women feel that everything is conspiring against them in order to have a child. So they know in theory that they have a choice. But I think, therefore, that this kind of rhetoric, my body, my choice, massively oversimplifies what is in reality a deeply complex and difficult situation. It's quite interesting to think why is becoming a parent so difficult in 2023?
Yeah, and there's certainly a challenge there, I think, for any Christians involved in anti-abortion activism to say the flip side of trying to make it harder for women to have an abortion, I believe, is that you need to be simultaneously working to make it easier for women to raise families. And that might look like, in your particular context, you know, what is the housing situation like? You know, what are there sufficient government benefits and welfare system to support poorer women to have another child? You know, is there a social care system? Is there a community healthcare system? You know, all these things need to be in place that would have the effect of making it giving women more of a real sense that they have a real choice between abortion or keeping the child.
Yeah, and so I think the wider context is that philosophers and thinkers often, you know, prize the principle of autonomy, this free, unfettered choice to do whatever I feel is the right. But that's what's the myth, because this is fine sitting from the philosopher's chair, but in reality, when human beings make painful and difficult choices, it's weighing all the social, personal, emotional, and practical issues, as well as the morality of what is right and wrong. And so I think the reality is that many women choose abortion with a very heavy heart. They would love to be a parent. They would love to experience all that. They don't intuitively feel abortion is a good thing, but they feel, I don't have a choice. It's really the only option, the only rational, reasonable option.
And I think sometimes Christians in the pro-life movement spend too much time responding to or attacking or becoming the antagonist of the quite kind of extreme I don't know what language to use, a kind of hyper-feminist position. You know, it's my body, I do what I want. It's no different to, you know, choosing to remove a kidney. You know, the state should have absolutely no regulation or limits on how I terminate my pregnancy, this kind of thing. You know, there's no stigma, there's no shame, blah, 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 blah. You know, that perspective certainly exists. But my instinct, and I think surveys back this up, is that it's actually fairly rare, and that the kind of median person, certainly in the UK, and I suspect probably also in the US and other parts of the Western world, believes that abortion should be legal, should be safe, but also should be rare. And they don't honestly believe that aborting a fetus is the equivalent to, you know, having a gallbladder out or something like that. It's, they understand, even if they might not see the unborn child having the same moral dignity and humanhood, personhood that we as Christians might ascribe to it, I think they understand intuitively that the consequences of aborting pregnancy are orders of magnitude greater, emotional, psychological, physical, familial, than they are in having your gallbladder out or doing any other kind of obviously kind of self-autonomizing medical procedure. And so I think actually it's important, as you say, that we as Christians engage with where people actually are at, not where we think they're at or where the kind of loudest pro-abortion cheerleaders would like to say people are at.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it comes back to a slogan that I've used many times before, but that is, whenever as Christians we say that something is wrong, we immediately have to go and say that here is a better way. And so how can we make the better way of continuing with the pregnancy with the right kind of psychological, emotional, practical, economic, social support How can we make that? How can the Christian community make that more attractive, more realistic? And I long for greater practical action from the churches. You know, it saddens me that so often the voice we hear in the public domain is often this negative voice that says this is bad, this is wrong, this is destructive, this is damaging lives, it's damaging women, instead of, look, here is a better way, and this is the way Christians are supporting, encouraging, and making this a reality. Wouldn't it be wonderful if our churches were seen as the place that a woman with an unplanned pregnancy, the woman with a single, unsupported child who's been abandoned by a partner, wouldn't it be wonderful if the church was the obvious place that people should turn to?
Hmm. And just last thing on this one, the listener David, who sent us a question. Thank you for sending that in. It's been a really helpful bit of clarification. He also said, helpfully pointed out this interesting website I've not come across before, which is a UK website called My Body, My Life, mybody-mylife.org. And it just intrigued me, Dad, because it's very similar to what you were saying at the end of our conversation, that you wish that, you know, there was a space for more women to share their abortion stories. And intriguingly, here is a website doing exactly that, but coming from the other perspective. You know, these are people who are pro-abortion, or at least pro that it being an option, and they believe that there is too much stigma around it, and so they've got a website where people can submit their stories, and you can read stories of people from having abortions as they, quote, work to remove the stigma around abortion. So it kind of intrigued me that there was someone who kind of landed on a similar project or a similar solution, but from a very different end of the spectrum.
Yeah, well, it's good that we desperately need to talk about this and to have a forum in which people can share their own honest story. It is interesting, isn't it? In this age of postmodernism and so on, the one thing that you can never deny someone is the right to tell their own story. Even if you feel their story is unacceptable and it's irrational and I don't agree with your story, you have the right to tell your story, and no one has the right to tell you, no, you're not allowed to share your story.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from NT Wright. Ask NT Wright Anything, the Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now let's get back to today's show.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Good. All right. Well, shall we move on to another issue? This was actually a news story that you spotted and sent me. It's in the magazine or the website wired.com. We'll put a link in the podcast description. The headline is this: millions of workers are training AI models for pennies. From the Philippines to Colombia, low-paid workers label training data for AI models used by the likes of Amazon, Facebook, Google, and Microsoft. And it's a story about one of the main characters is a woman called Oscarina Fuentes from Venezuela, which, as people know, has been stuck in this kind of economic political crisis. Inflation has hit 800%. And she found out through a friend about an Australian data services company that would hire her to work online to basically do tag training data for AI algorithms. So that's things like, you know, telling which one of these five pictures is a car, labeling that one, or commenting on, you know, which of these is a more accurate AI generated summary of something. which is the kind of hidden part of how all of these AI models like ChatGPT that we become familiar with work. And the story basically explains that actually a large part, the kind of backbone of a lot of that training of these AI models is relies on incredibly low paid people from the developing world, places like East Africa, Venezuela, the Philippines, India, even refugee camps, where people are being paid a few cents each for a single task on a platform. They've got no long-term job security. They have to be available to work any hour of the day, 24 hours a day. And they might, at best, barely scrape together a few hundred dollars a month. Why did you find this story interesting? What jumped out at it to you?
Yeah, no, I think it's tragic, really, because, you know, it's often said that there are parallels between the old-fashioned mining industry extracting, you know, metals and ore out of the earth, and the newfangled industry of data mining, data extraction. And just as old-fashioned mining has so often depended on the exploitation of incredibly poorly paid workers in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo and other low-resource countries around the world, and often child labor or exploited extremely poor people are mining the, you know, the rare metals which we need in our smartphones and so on, and being exploited in the process. So the same pattern is being repeated when it comes to data analysis, and incredibly rich companies, commercial companies, mainly in the West, are employing in what has to be said is an exploitative way, extremely cheap labor in the same countries to do often extremely, not only numbingly repetitive and mindless, but sometimes these people are watching deeply disturbing videos, for instance, in content moderation, or they may be being employed to train AI models like ChatGPT, and they have to therefore respond to what are often extremely unpleasant comments which these models create, which are then all carefully moderated. So these people are doing the work so we don't have to. So when we go on to ChatGPT, it's always very nice and friendly and anodyne. And that's because, you know, thousands of hours have been spent, often at very poor rates, by human beings trying to moderate and remove and minimize unacceptable content from these models.
But hang on a second. I mean, to put on my big business hat for a second, couldn't you argue that actually, from another perspective, this is a positive example of how digital technology can transform people's economic outlook? Because, you know, a lot of these people in slums or in the developing world, they would otherwise maybe have to go and, you know, sell things on the street or be sucked into genuinely kind of dangerous exploitative physical labor, and instead, because of the connectivity of the internet, they can sit on a laptop at home in safety and tap things on a keyboard, and in return they are paid for their work. Admittedly, not very much money, but it goes a lot further in that country than it would here in the West. Isn't that a good news story? Isn't that about how the digital revolution and our new industrial revolution is actually creating jobs for poorer people that aren't, as you know, they don't destroy their bodies by hacking rock out of the earth, and they're not breathing in disgusting dirty air or whatever else. They're just sitting at a computer in quiet comfort and safety, tapping at a screen.
Well, that's the nice sort of, that's the spin. It's just there's a terrible disconnect between that wonderful spin and the harsh reality, which you get in the Wired magazine article. We'll link to it in the chat. But this lady who's taken as an example, Fuentes, typically an hour and a half of work will bring in $1. But actually, sometimes Fuentes works on a laptop from her bed, glued to her computer for over 18 hours a day, because there is a drying up in the tasks, and she's just trying to get the first pick of tasks. And the only way she can do that, can you imagine spending 18 hours on your laptop because you daren't miss this task, which is going to come and give you the grand total of a dollar for an hour's and a half's work? You know, Now, technically, people say, well, isn't that great? I mean, a dollar, that's, but it, you know, it's just not right that that is funding billionaires, you know, the people who are running the tech industry. The coders, you know, who are making this software are earning hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And it's this extraordinarily exploitative inequality. The very inequality is damaging. When you have that kind of gradient of 100,000 times between what the top coders are earning and what the people who are doing these digital tasks in poor countries, you know, that just can't be right. I mean, yeah. I just compare that with the Old Testament concept of, you know, focusing on widows and orphans and aliens, and therefore that the people who are sowing the fields and harvesting the fields had to leave areas for gleaning and allow the widows to come and obtain food for free. Because
it's a major
kind
of plot point in the Book of Ruth, isn't it?
Exactly.
We talked about that on a Prentice episode, that without that, Ruth wouldn't have been able to survive.
Absolutely. And so yes, the idea that there should be provision made for people who are absolutely the bottom of the heap, and that the challenge is for just and righteous employment practices and the possibility of exploitation. This poor woman, desperate to survive, spending 18 hours glued to a laptop. Yeah, that can't be right.
There's another case they quote in the Wired piece, a man called McMain, who's just 18, from Pakistan, who said he actually started this work at 15 using a family member's ID to get around the kind of child labour regulations. And he works on a laptop from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then does another shift from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. every day. He says, I need to stick to these platforms at all times so that I don't lose work, but he struggles to earn more than $50 a month. And he says he's only compensated for the time actually spent entering details on the platform, which massively underestimates his labour. For instance, a social media related task may pay a dollar or two per hour, but the fee doesn't account for the additional research time spent online. Quote, one needs to work 5 or 6 hours to complete what effectively amounts to an hour of real-time work, all to earn $2. In my point of view, it is digital slavery.
Yeah, and so it's worth remembering that, you know, when we go on to ChatGPT or use these other wonderful generative AI models, are we aware of the digital slavery that some people around the world have contributed? And what do we do with this knowledge? I mean, this is where there's a democratic deficit, a way of saying we don't want to do that. You know what? We're prepared to pay more for an AI service if we knew that it had been done in a genuinely honourable and equitable way, if it had been trained and developed from the ground up. Because we believe that this is important and we're prepared to put our money where our mouth is.
And it's particularly egregious, as you said earlier, because we know that most of the companies, the end users of this data, are literally the richest corporations to have ever existed. You know, Apple has a sitting on a mountain of about $100 billion in cash just sitting there in its bank account. Doesn't really have anything to do with it because it's making so much money from selling iPhones and MacBooks and Apple TV subscriptions and whatever else. And that's equally true of Google, you know, which is just a machine but generating revenue mostly through its advertising businesses. Like, these are incredibly wealthy companies that if they wanted to double, treble, quadruple the wages of their kind of irregular workforce in the developing world, it would make no dent really on their long-term profit margins. So there really is no excuse, in my view.
Absolutely. And you know, it reminds me falsely. I've just been reading recently the passages in Revelation, which talks about, it's really, Revelation is a tale of two cities. You know, this happened before Dickens. And on the one hand, you've got Babylon. And the other hand, you've got the New Jerusalem. And Babylon is astonishingly wealthy. But it is built on extortion. I mean, the whole point in Revelation of why Babylon is ultimately under God's judgment is because It is that wealth, that obscene wealth that Babylon represents, which of course was actually a picture of Rome. It was code for Rome, and the Roman Empire was built on this level of exploitation of slaves and of poor people and so on. And so, you know, here's the new Babylon. The trouble is we're all in some way involved. We're all affected and some way complicit with the new Babylon.
Yeah. This kind of comes in the context, we talked about this briefly before, but here in the UK, there's just finished a big AI safety summit held at Bletchley Park, which was famously the location of the code breakers in World War II, who led by, well, among them, Alan Turing, who helped kind of develop the world's first computers to crack the Germans' Enigma code and help win the war. And this has been a big push by the UK Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, to try and get big countries to sit down and agree kind of basic rules and regulations about how we're going to keep AI developments so that they are safe. Have you been following this much? Do you have any hope or kind of optimism that these kind of international diplomatic efforts might actually kind of rein in some of the tech companies that are furiously developing this capability?
I'm very conflicted on this. I mean, it was a stroke of genius, the optics to do it at Bletchley Park. Because, as you say, Bletchley has this almost sacred reputation as the home of the origins of computing in many ways, and the place where Alan Turing and others cracked the Enigma code, which had such a significance for the Allies in World War II. So to actually do it on this hallowed site. Interestingly, I think what's been happening is that the UK has been feeling incredibly sidelined from the global conversation on AI, because ever since it left the EU, I mean, again, it was an unanticipated side effects of Brexit, because the EU plays a very powerful role in global politics on digital technology. And a very good example is GDPR, which was invented and created by the EU as a way of controlling people's rights of privacy, data control, and so on. And grudgingly, the entire rest of the world, particularly all the American big tech giants, have had to adopt this American regulation, this European regulation, even though they hate it, because it's very restrictive. But, you know, they had no choice. If the whole of Europe was going to insist on this, they couldn't end up with two versions of the technology, one for Europe and one for the rest of the world. And so they basically, Europe was able to enforce a global standard. And previously, Britain played a very big role within the EU and in this area. But following Brexit, Britain is out in the cold. So the three big blocks are America, China, and Europe. And Britain is nowhere. So this was an attempt to try and say, we're still here. We're still important.
Pay
attention to us. That's right.
We actually do have a tech sector.
Yeah. And we used to be very important in the Second World War. I'm probably being overly cynical. I think there is a genuine desire to try to bring people together. But I think there are lots of concerns that so many of the people who turned up were the people who are already running the industry. A lot of what Bletchley Park came out of could be, if you're being cynical, could be said to, you know, just we're in favor of motherhood and apple pie. You know, it's human rights, transparency, explainability, fairness, accountability, regulation, safety, human oversight, ethics, privacy, you know, and who wouldn't be in favor of all those things? The problem is how you turn these warm, well-meaning words into some kind of licensing, which really has a fight. And actually, it's interesting. There is a very serious division and debate going on now about AI safety. Everyone's agreed that we want to try and restrict the possibilities of these new, very, very powerful AI models from being used for harm. But there are two competing visions. One, which most of the big tech companies are saying, is we want to be regulated. Please, sir, we want to be regulated. Please regulate us, sir. And they're going to the politicians and demanding and requesting rights, but rules to regulate them. But of course, we're going to write the rules to help you, sir, because we're the only ones who actually understand how this works, sir. So we're going to write your rules and then we'll show you that we're following the rules that we've written for you. A lot of people are what's now being called regulatory capture, that the big tech companies have actually captured the politicians because of their technical prowess and also because of the amount of lobbying spend that they're spending to make their influence. So the other view is a smaller group of open source enthusiasts who are saying, what we've got to do, the only way to make this safe is to release it completely into the wild and make it available and open for everybody to use. And that way, all the tech community will be take it apart, play with it, work out what's dangerous, and come up with safety rules. And the other side is saying, no, that's incredibly dangerous. If you just release it in the wild, you're inviting bad people. So it's interesting, there are two quite competing visions here of the right way forward. And it's almost like you can't have both, and yet they're both there. They're both happening at the same time. I don't know which one's going to win.
And in truth, the reason the big companies don't want to open up their models for scrutiny is because they don't want to have to share the technology, because they see this as an inflection point. This is like where we were in the late 1990s, when there are a number of people trying to crack the problem of internet search. And Google won that race by creating the best product and turned itself into the second wealthiest company in history as a result, through its dominance of search. And there is a hope and expectation that AI will be the next kind of breakthrough transformational product. And so whichever company ends up kind of winning the race to genuine working transformational AI thinks it could unlock trillions of dollars in future value. And they'll be damned if they let anyone else copy and see the inner workings of their complex algorithm. Let's be honest, it's not. That's really what's lying behind this, as well as maybe some genuine fears around safety.
Well, and it's, and this is, you know, it's that old saw, isn't it? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And given the billions of dollars that are resting on this, it's not surprising that there is, you know, there's a degree of you know, corruption, maybe a strong word, but it's conflicts of interest. So there is it's a fascinating point in history, but it's really unclear which way this is going to go. So what is being proposed by the regulators is that basically producing one of these new AI models should be like, you know, producing an airplane for flight. It cannot be released until it has gone through a very rigorous certification process, which means that highly skilled computer scientists employed by the government get the model before release and take it apart and test it, flight test it, just like they would do an aircraft. And before it's certified and has the stamp of approval, it can't be released into general release. But of course, the other voices and the tech giants are saying, if you make this too onerous, if you make this too difficult and delay us in getting this wonderful stuff out, of course, you're just handing to our competitors. It will mean, you know, and particularly to China, we'll regulate ourselves out of existence. Meanwhile, China will get on. And so a very confused and confusing picture. And at the moment, it's hard to see what the right way forward is. But I think we need to ask the question, how can this technology be taken away from the pursuit of profit and actually used for human flourishing? How can we create AI which actually helps human beings to become more virtuous instead of exploiting often the very negative aspects of our character, the fallenness? You know, it seems like social media just has this effect, doesn't it, of exacerbating and amplifying human frailty and hatred and division and so on. So we want the reverse. We want technology which actually suppresses this fallen human nature and which instead encourages us to behave in a responsible way, to be thoughtful, to be caring, to be compassionate, to spend more time in face-to-face relationships and less time staring at our screens. Is this a pipe dream? Is this just ridiculous? Or would it be possible to imagine technology which was actually genuinely for human good?
And I feel quite convicted on this one, because the cynical journalist part of me says, you know, there is no realistic likelihood that the world is going to be able to get a handle on this and restrain these immensely wealthy and powerful companies that are pursuing this with all their might. But the other part of me says, you know, think about our recent episode on The Fall. You know, we talked before about the systemic, structural, corrupting nature of sinfulness, and that we went through our first kind of generation, you know, of the internet and social media, and it was all mostly done with really good intent and has produced a lot of bitter fruit, unintentional bitter fruit that we discussed many times on the show. And I would love for us to say, rather than just repeat that mistake with our general artificial intelligence kind of era season, I would love for us to try a different way. I don't really know if regulation of the type you described is realistic or could work, but it seems to me, you know, if you do the same thing twice and expect different results, it's a definition of insanity. You know, we've tried the kind of self-regulation, let's let the tech companies do it themselves, you know, fail fast, fail often, move fast, break things. And that gave us, you know, some horrendous, horrendous things. It unleashed, as you say, some of the worst parts of human nature, amplified some of our most corrupting, divisive, broken, harmful parts of us. I would love for us to try a different way this time round, when the stakes might even be, as people say, so much higher with what a harmful, destructive AI model could do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm with you. And I think, you know, this is where, from a Christian perspective, there is reason for hope. So, yes, you know, we take the fall seriously. Yes, there is a profound evil here, which can be not that the technology is evil, but that it somehow amplifies and encourages and can stimulate human evil. But the story doesn't stop there. The story, the grand narrative, goes on to redemption and says, you know, the power of life, the power of forgiveness, the power of truth, the power of goodness, and above all, the power revealed paradoxically in the cross of Christ is greater than evil, is greater than the fall. There is a way forward. And so, you know, theologically, what I'm praying for is a sense of, how do we ground that? What does redeeming technology actually look like? What does redeeming AI, bringing it back out of the territory of evil and using it for good, for the common good, for the good of humankind, and particularly for vulnerable people? So instead of exploiting the people in Africa and Colombia and elsewhere, technology is genuinely empowering them and giving them a greater dignity, a greater value, a greater level of humanity.
Amen to all of that. Seems like a neat place to finish. Thanks very much for those who've been sending in questions. Please do continue, or even if it's just to send us a link or for a new story or a development in technology or science you'd like us to respond to, that's really helpful. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. Don't forget to look at Dad's website, johnwyatt.com. Lots of interesting things to read, listen to, and watch. And we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If your brain is at full capacity with to-dos, birthdays, and dinner plans, meet Skylight Calendar. It syncs your entire family schedule onto a sleek digital display so you focus on important things like where you left your coffee. Right now, Skylight is offering our listeners $30 off their 15-inch calendars by going to skylightcal.com/talk. Go to skylightcal.com/talk for $30 off your 15-inch calendar. That's skylightcal.com/talk.
Lo sabe que ahora más que nunca buscas el precio más bajo. Por eso, cuenta con nuestra garantía de precios bajos para obtener lo que necesitas a precios competitivos para tus proyectos. Y si encuentras un artículo igual a un precio más bajo que califica, te lo igualaremos. Lowe's. Nosotros ayudamos. Tú ahorras. Igualación de precio aplica al artículo igual con un precio actual en tiendas calificadas. Aplican términos y exclusiones. Detalles en Lowe's.com/garantía precios bajos.